Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. So this morning, I want to continue I've been teaching over these past months, but also when I'm not here, other people are teaching from this text, practice text within the Buddhist tradition that actually came from India. It was preserved in Tibet, but now being shared around the world, which are these what's called mind trainings in Tibetan. It's Lojong. There are these 57 or 58 very pithy aphorism slogans that basically, in a very simple way, remind us and train us in how to keep our minds, how to think clearly, how to have thoughts that support showing up in the world in an intelligent, wise, and compassionate way, rather than the opposite. These slogans, there are a lot of commentaries on them. There are a lot of books you can get these days, as well as on our website. A lot of the past talks are recorded. So how many people are new and sort of these, they haven't heard the introductory kind of, okay, so there's somebody. So very quickly, and again, there's, you can get information elsewhere. So there are these 57 or 58 very pithy slogans, and they're divided into sections. And the first section is called the preliminaries. And it basically is setting forth that for whatever our spiritual life is, or whatever our spiritual practices are, before we engage in the practices, we need to have a way of looking at life that kind of allows us to look at life with some degree of sanity, some degree of intelligence. You know, like, in other words, like, what's going on here in this life? You know, why are people the way they are? Why does the world unfold the way it unfolds? So we're not always, deeply disturbed by by the world and by people and by the way things are unfolding. There is some kind of fundamental understanding. I won't go into it. We have lots of teachings on this, but that's sort of the preliminaries. It's sort of like the way I see it, it's sort of like before you build a house, you need a strong foundation. If you don't have a foundation, you can put up a very attractive house, but there's no stability there, right? And there are many people who sort of put up a spiritual religious edifice in their life, but because they don't have a strong foundation, it is always wobbling. It's always beginning to tilt. And actually, it can actually have major structural issues. And so there are many people who lead a religious or spiritual life or a meditative life, and yet because they don't have a strong foundation in view and ethics or whatever, you see all the distortions that are unfortunately so present in the world of people who outwardly say they're following a spiritual religious path, or you can be leaders of these things, and yet we see in the way they conduct themselves, the way they interact, there's something really off, right? So this foundation for all of us is so important. And again, we have to be careful because, you know, for many of us, again, we're Americans, we're higher achievers, you know, let's get on with the good stuff, right? Let's get into the meditation, let's get into the higher teachings. But I assure you, spending some time at the preliminaries on the foundation is essential, if you're in it for the long term. Now then he does something very interesting in these teachings. He goes from this foundation, he then goes to sort of what in Buddhism we might call the absolute or unconditioned view. All of this is subsumed under something which is called bodhicitta in Sanskrit, or the awakened mind. So we know Buddhism is very much about, going back to the Buddha just means someone who is awakened. It's not his family name, it wasn't his personal name, it was what he was called after his great awakening. He's an awakened one. He's an enlightened one. He is someone who has opened to his awakened mind. And so all the wholesome qualities of the mind can naturally come forth. But within this awakened mind, there's sort of two ways of looking at it, sort of like micro and macro. In Buddhism, we call this absolute and relative. So it's sort of like down here on Earth, sort of where we all dwell. We might call that, you know, the relative view. We're here in the world, and all the things that are going on in the world, and we're interacting with the world and each other, and right, it's all very kind of small. And it's almost like if we could then, you know, in some kind of science fiction way, you know, go far away into the cosmos, you know, far, far away, where all of a sudden the Earth, the solar system, even our universe, which is one of many, is just like a tiny little dot, right? You see, it's like down here, everything is like really big, right? But into the unfolding of these endless universes, what goes on down here is what? Hate to say it, what? What? Not very important, is it, to the unfolding? Hate to say it. Okay? And so what he then does, he then goes into what Buddhism is called the unconditioned or the absolute view, the view from Buddha nature. Okay? And there are these wonderful teachings, again, very simply, which actually show us how to experience and realize this bigger, absolute, unconditioned view of things, okay? Which is primarily what meditation is about. So that's already been taught, and we teach that here in our Dharma and wisdom path. Now, what I want to get into today is what's called relative bodhicitta. And so it's sort of interesting developmentally how this thing operates. First, strong foundation in what's view and ethics and all that. Then big view, right? Wide view. So you kind of have a context in which, you know, life, our individual life, the life of everybody in the world is unfolding, right? That's like the big view. And then after with the foundation and the big view, now we come back to what? Our life and how we show up in life. Okay? Which is really, at the end of the day, our major concern. Right? I mean, the challenge for all of us is, you know, in this life, you know, how can I live this life with a mind that is calm, that is peaceful, that is tranquil? How can I live this life in all of the situations of life with wisdom and intelligence and sanity? And how can I show up in all my relations in a kind and loving and compassionate way? Right? It's both the challenge for us individually and challenge really for the world. And so this is called in these formal teachings relative bodhicitta. It's sort of like, you know, if you have the foundation and if you have the big view, well, how do you live it? And most of these aphorisms in here are about how to live it, right? So that's why this is a very wonderful and very practical text. So it begins called train in taking and sending alternately and put them on the breath. Now, I'm really not going to go too much into this today because this is a very specific meditation practice, but I want to talk about it a little bit. So this train in taking and sending alternately, put them on the breath, is a teaching, is a practice of how to be present to suffering. How to be present to our own individual suffering, and how to be present to the suffering of others, and how to be present to the suffering of the world. Right? And this is a very, I think we all know, this is a very fundamental, if not the most fundamental, issue that we all face. Right? You know, and just to digress a moment, you know, we cannot help if we are somewhat attentive to the news and what's going on in the world, that there is incredible suffering at all different levels. Excuse me. In Buddhism, suffering has many different... Excuse me. So we have little tiny sufferings like this, which is a great tiny suffering. And then we have, you know, sort of ordinary sufferings, the suffering of sickness, the suffering of loss, the suffering of aging, the suffering of change, right? And yet we also have all kinds of other sufferings that human beings inflict, sufferings of violence, the sufferings of deprivation, the sufferings of, you know, injustice, you know, so many sufferings that human beings endure and human beings give to one another. And the fundamental issue is, going back to the Buddha, I mean, one of the things, you know, that was so important to understand about the Buddha, his life was, outwardly, he had a good life, right? I mean, he had ease in his social strata there in little principality in northern India. He was on the top, you know, he was in the kind of nobility class. He had a nice wife, he had a son, you know, he had the whole thing, right? And yet, when he began to look deeply into life, he saw this condition of suffering. And that even with all the good things in life, ordinary people suffer, because what do they suffer from? You know, their health doesn't, they don't always stay healthy. They get sick and they get disease and they age. And eventually everyone dies, which sort of kind of puts into question all the things that we work so hard for because they have no permanence or solidity to them. So he saw this. In the face of all this, he saw how human beings, in their desire to be happy, seem to only create more suffering for themselves. And even if they create happiness for themselves, it's only temporary. So the Buddha, you know, looking at suffering was a fundamental issue for his, and resolving that for him was important. And in this text, it's an important, and it's a challenge for all of us. And I think when you know, I personally read the news and I see this, you know, the things that are going on, and the things that are going on in the name of our country, right? You know, for example, with the immigrants, you know, or the you know, all those names we give our brothers and sisters, right? And again, it's not saying that there aren't different views on immigration policy and borders. You know, I mean, that's part of life and part of governments and having nations and all that. I understand that. But these issues are fundamentally ethical issues. Right? You know, the foundation of Buddhist ethics is do no harm, do whatever you can to protect life. Right? So simple. You know, do not create suffering. Do your best to ease the suffering of others. And so I think it's very important that we be very careful as a society and as a people in society that issues that are fundamentally ethical, right? About how do we treat each other? You know, how do I want to be treated? When our ancestors came to this country and we all our ancestors all came to this country. Right? Why did they come here? What? What? Better life. Right? For all kinds of reasons. I mean, that motivation to want to have a better life, and it wasn't just a better life for themselves, it was also their better life for what? Their children. Right? And so, again, all I'm saying to you, we have to really be clear that as an individual, how we show up, and as a family, how we show up, and as a community, how we show up, and as a political body, how we show up, that we don't get confused by issues being turned into political issues, sectarian issues. You know what I'm saying? They're fundamentally moral issues, ethical issues. And so what do we do in the face of suffering? And so this practice of what's called Tonglen, this exchange, is a practice that says, do not turn away from suffering. Do not repress, do not be indifferent to suffering. And on the other hand, do not let suffering cause you suffering. It's very profound. Because for many people, in the face of suffering, their own suffering, the suffering of others, there's such a profound uncomfortableness that we either want to turn away from it, become callous or indifferent or powerless, or else we just kind of take it on. You know, so we suffer. but both those responses, what's missing in those responses? The ability to respond to the suffering. So in Buddhism, compassion, which is what we're talking about, karuna, is not empathy. And empathy is what connects us to another human being, right? We are empathic. We have some recognition that what they're feeling is what we're feeling. That's what somebody feels in a situation. But compassion in and of itself in Buddhism, karuna, means that in the face of suffering, the response is there anything I can do to be of benefit? And that type of response, whether there is something to do or not something that can be done, is a positive emotion. Right? And an empowering emotion, because it allows us to connect to the suffering person, but it immediately allows us to respond in a wholesome and positive, loving, caring way, which is there anything I can do to alleviate that suffering? And that capacity, which is what they call here this practice of Tonglen, this practice of the exchange, is an act of willingness to be engaged with the suffering, one's own suffering, and the suffering of others in a very personal and intimate way, and to immediately respond with, you know, something wholesome and positive. Even if it's just in our mind. Because actually the practices, if you think about compassion or lack of compassion, you know, everything, and this is why in Buddhism, you know, meditation is so essential. Because there's an acknowledgement that we act, we speak and we act physically and with our words, primarily driven by our mind, right? I mean, thoughts, ideas, emotions are all arising where? In our mind. Our values, our ethics, they are of the mind, Our beliefs, our ideas, our dogmas, our tenets, they're all of the mind. So training the mind is the most essential thing. When the mind is trained in compassion, then the speech and the body will act in a compassionate way. So in Buddhism, mind training is considered essential because it is a priori what comes first. When I have a compassionate mind, when I have a mind that is able to be present to suffering in a positive and meaningful way, then the actions of my words and the actions of my body will then flow from that. But if in my mind I do not have a compassionate, loving mind, or I am deeply uncomfortable or don't know what to do in the face of my own suffering or the suffering of others or the suffering of the world, then the actions of my body and speech will always be somewhat contaminated. And even if we act with words or actions that seem appropriate to the situation, but if our mind is not, you know, in congruence, you know, there will be suffering within ourselves. And we don't want to suffer, do we? Does anybody here want to suffer? No. I mean, it's so reasonable. Does anybody want their loved ones to suffer? Does anybody want their friends to suffer? No. We want people to be what? Happy or at peace, or, you know, that it's so simple at that level. And yet we look at the world, as we were talking a few minutes ago, and have to ask yourself, well, if that's really the case, right? How simple it is. If that's really the case, then why do people treat each other in such a different kind of way, even within their families, even within their friendships, even within their small groups, even within much less the world? Why don't people just do it? It's so obvious, right? And the answer can only be that there is something inherently, fundamentally skewed in our minds. Can anybody guess what that is? We all know better. What is fundamentally skewed that prevents us from acting from this open-hearted, loving, kind, compassionate way with ourselves, those we love, those we care about, family, friends, going on and on out, and into the world? We weren't taught to? Well, maybe, but I think many of us grew up hearing these words in our churches and temples and whatever, right? And it's not as if even the people who are perpetuating these kinds of things don't. Ego. Yeah. So, a little later down the line, there is another slogan. It says, all Dharma has a single purpose. And Dharma has many meanings, a Sanskrit word, but basically it means all the teachings and practices that we undertake, you know, in any kind of spiritual, religious context, according to this teaching, says, has one purpose. And he comments, since the purpose of all Dharma is simply to tame ego clinging, as you practice Dharma or work at mind training, ego clinging should decrease. If your efforts in Dharma do not counteract ego clinging, your practice is meaningless. Very strong words. Since this is the one criteria that determines whether Dharma practice is effective or not, it is said to be the yardstick by which a Dharma person is measured. which is very interesting, because many people think that spiritual life, meditative life, spiritual practice, Dharma practice, is predicated on what? How successful I am at the practice, right? So somebody might say, gee, I'm really a terrible meditator, whew, right? Or, all kinds of things, you know. Or one may think, well, gee, I'm really a great meditator. My meditation is really getting much better. And I'm a very good Dharma practitioner. Or I'm, you know, really studying a lot of Buddhism, and I really could converse widely on the teachings, and I, you know what I'm saying? Gee, I'm really making great strides. Now, it doesn't mean in those areas you're not making great strides. But I think what he's setting forth to us is, you know, it's all in the pursuit of what? You see? I mean, if we're making great strides in our cooking, it means we are able to what? 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 Cook better. There you go. Yeah, this is not a trick question. Thank you, Rick. Yeah. Like, invite people over and people say, wow, Rick's getting, she used to hate coming over to his house. He was such a terrible cook. But, you know, since he's been watching the Food Channel, he's really, all right. You see, there's got to be some criteria, right? It can't just be that Rick says, I spend 4 hours a day watching the Food Channel. I read all these books. So, you know, I'm taking online courses. Well, that's wonderful, Rick. You see what I'm saying? But are you a better cook? You see, that has to be the criteria. And so all of us need a criteria, right, for our spiritual life, our meditative life, whatever it is. And here they're saying there's only one purpose, and that is to reduce our ego clinging. Ego clinging is, you know, has lots of meanings in Buddhism, but it really points to a fundamental teaching of the Buddha. When he looked at, again, the great capacity that this human mind has for goodness, for wisdom and intelligence and compassion and patience and loving kindness, you know, all those wonderful qualities of the mind, and has therefore the capacity of creating in all our relationships, which means the relationships with everyone from the most immediate to the world. Why don't we? Right? What's getting in the way? Now, traditionally, we might say what's getting in the way is what? The outside world, or the people running Washington, or the people, you know what I mean? We're always going, that's the reason. But why are they the way they are? Right? Why are they the way they are? And what he's saying here, it's because in their delusions, human beings primarily identify themselves as an independent person. Right? Where the independent person who identifies in that way, concerns in life are what? All about myself. My happiness, my well-being, right? My needs, my desires, my. And if you have a world of people who are fundamentally concerned with their own needs and desires, right? The my. Well, no wonder they cannot even see what's going on with other human beings. Or if they do, not, you know, respond there seems to be somebody playing with me upstairs. So again, what we're beginning to look at is something very fundamental, fundamental to each one of us as individuals, as well as, I think, very fundamental to the way the world is operating, why things are going on the way they are in the world. And unfortunately, many of us, even though we hate to admit it, our lives parallel the lives of the leaders who we have so much objection to. See, most of us act out our egocentricity and our self-centeredness in a very tiny little world, right? You see, we're sort of small people, aren't we? We don't act on the great stage of the world, do we? Right? But in our own little narrow world, if we were honest, we'd say, yeah, I often don't show up in a very compassionate, loving, kind way, right? To myself or to others. Right? I'm not really that connected or respond to the suffering I see even around me, because I'm primarily concerned with who? With me. My needs, my wants, my concerns, my desires, my safety, my ego needs. You know, we're just... And so we see, even in our own little bubble, we act in the world that way. You know, and all that happens is, as people kind of go up the social ladder, so to speak, or whatever it's called, and get more and more power, more and more influence, all they're doing is what? The same thing. Right? And so so somebody said, I think earlier, well, it's, you know, no one taught us. And I think there's a certain truth to that. We were taught the words, right? What's that fundamental question? Am I my brother's keeper? I would say my brother and sister's keeper, right? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Anybody ever hear that one? Yeah, it's like, I mean, you know, sort of as I said, that it reminds me of this Zen anecdote where this, I think he's the emperor or something, hears about this great Zen master lives up in the mountains and known for his wisdom or whatever, so, you know, keeps inviting him to come down to the, you know, to the palace or something, but the master says, no, I never leave, you know, the mountains. So finally, the, you know, sort of like the mountain one comes, you know, Muhammad goes to the mountain. So the king, the emperor, his entourage goes up into the mountains, long journey to meet this master. He finally meets him and he says to him, master, tell me, what is the deepest, most profound teaching of Buddhism? And the master says, do no harm, do no good, and be compassionate to every living being. The emperor's outraged, right? Because what the master just said to him was like, do unto others as you, you know, it's sort of like if you, you know, journeyed, you know, 10,000 miles going through every hardship because the greatest, you know, Christian saint, you know, when you get there and he tells you something, you know, which you heard in, you know, first grade, you see, you'd become what? You know, so that's what the emperor is. So the emperor goes, what? He says, every school child in China knows, you know, do no harm, only do good and work for the liberation of, you know, of all beings. You know, every school child, I mean, he was pissed, okay? And the master looks at him and says, you're absolutely right. Every school child in China can repeat that, but you know what? It's even difficult for an old man of 86 to practice it. Right? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. What does that mean as we look around the world? Right? What if that was us on the border? Or our cousins, or our aunts and uncles? How would we respond, right? If we saw the other as no different than ourself. It changes things, right? To have that kind of understanding, to be willing to let go of this very little narrow world we live in, this self-centered world we live in, and to become, it's not as if we have to, live in denial of self, this is not that, but it's at least acknowledging that I am no different than anyone else. Everyone else is just like me. And for me only to care for my own happiness and not care about the happiness of others, if I only care about eliminating or alleviating my own suffering and not alleviating the suffering of others, is sort of to fundamentally miss the point of our interconnection and our sameness, right? In this world. So I think these two teachings, one, the centrality of learning how to be in with suffering and to transform it into compassion, and then to really have a criteria for judging our proficiency in whatever spiritual, meditative, religious, a path we are following, that clearly delineates, we can tell success because our self-centeredness, our narcissism, our ego clinging is lessening. And that, again, that shows up in what? That shows up in relationships, right? Which these days, relationships, if there's one thing that people have problems with these days or have problems in, is what? Anybody notice that? I mean, it's like, if you want to be rich, write a bestseller about relationships, right? I mean, a new solution this year. Sort of right up there with diet books, they're kind of, right? But oftentimes, many of the problems we have in relationships is the inability of two human beings to see the sameness of each other. Right? To see, oh, they're just like me. They have their needs, they have their wants, they have their sufferings, just like me. What if I was as concerned about their happiness as my own happiness? What if I was just as concerned about alleviating their sufferings as I am about mine? What if I was just as concerned about, see, it's interesting. Do we want other people to hear us? Yes. Are we that interested in hearing other people? Often not. See, we want the world to respond to us very compassionately, don't we? And to be very concerned about us and helpful to us and supportive of us. We would love that if the world was like that. And many of us say that is the way we show up in the world. And when I say the world, that's very abstract, but I mean, all our relationships. Right? So this is a very profound teaching that, again, the wonderful thing about it by being a Dharma teaching is, and this is very, again, fundamental to the spiritual religious view, it's like we don't demand that the world be the way we think it should be. Right? We demand that I should be the way I think I should be. Because that's the one demand I can fulfill. It can begin with me. I don't have to wait for the world. I don't have to wait for others to act and interact the way I think a person should. Do I? I can begin right now with me. I mean, if I'm going to have high standards in this life, let me have them for myself. And let me be impeccable in how the actions of my body, speech, and mind are congruent with my values, with my aspirations, with my intentions. Can I wish for a world where everyone treated each other wonderfully and compassionately and helpful, right? I can certainly wish that for the world. I can certainly do actions in the world that maybe contribute to that. But will the world respond the way I want it to be and become the way I want it to be? Yes or no? We don't know, do we? We have no control over that, do we? But the one person we do have control over is ourselves. So that's why in the Buddhist tradition, the personal transformation is so important. We don't wait. We don't have to wait. Anyhow, why don't we, I'm interested in your responses, your challenges, what this means to you, anything not clear, how to practice this, or, yes. Wait 1 second, Walter. We do, we don't? Thank you, Rayla.
I've been sitting here trying to figure out how to frame this question. A lot of times when you're compassionate and caring, mm-hmm. people take advantage. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. So again, you know, at other time we could talk more specifically, but it's really hard to, because, you know, it's, first of all, let me just say, in Buddhism, you know, there's the Bodhisattva of compassion has many arms, and in each of those arms is an eye. And that eye is the eye of wisdom, discernment. So, if you think about it, Walter, a compassionate act means an act that is geared toward helping relieve suffering. Right? So the most obvious thing, you might say, gee, I did a compassionate act. I have a friend who's an addict, and they were, you know, out of money, and they couldn't, you know. And so they asked me, you know, they were suffering, and they asked me, you know, could I loan them some money so they could score? And Walter says, well, isn't that the compassionate thing to do, right? They're suffering, and I'm alleviating their suffering. Now, I know you wouldn't do that, but you see, so we have to understand that suffering and compassion and the alleviation of suffering has to have some intelligence or discernment. So that's, first of all, it's not just a kind act. Because a kind act may be not really helping anybody. It may just be perpetuating it. Right? Okay? So let's say there is discernment, right? You know, someone you know is suffering. You do something that you're hoping will alleviate their suffering. Right? Right? Now, can you end right there? We're not attached to outcome. We're not looking for praise. We don't know if it's going to work. Do we? No. So we have to let go. We have to, you know, we are showing up in the world in a compassionate way. Why? Because that's the way we want to show up in the world. I can't control how the world responds to me. Right? Can I? No. Much less an individual human being. Right? Yeah. So in Buddhism, we have another thing, which is called non-attachment to outcome, which is very important. It means like, you know, it's like we just let it go. We act. It's a free act. We're doing our best. Hopefully we're coming from a good place. Let's see what happens. I mean, is that getting at what your question was or not?
Yeah, it's pretty much getting there. I guess you have to be very discerning who you help and who you care for and why you're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah. I mean, there has to be some discernment, right? Because again, sometimes we can think we're helping people and we're harming them. Or we're just perpetuating. I had a conversation, I think, a couple of weeks ago when I was here with somebody, and I was saying to them, you know, if you have somebody who has some drama, you know, in their life or some, you know, and it's like, this is years. And every time you get together, they go on and on about it. Or every time you talk on the phone, they go on and on about it. Is just being a good listener helping them? You see what I'm saying? You'd say, but hold on. I thought our practice here is mindful listening and deep listening. Isn't that, hold on. You see what I'm saying? Isn't that, that's a contradiction. But it's not a contradiction because, you know, the important thing is, am I alleviating suffering? Somebody tells you some terrible thing that's happened to them and your response is you listen and you're supportive. Next week they tell you the same story. Next week they tell you the same story. You know, 6 months later they're telling you the same story and they're still upset about it and you realize by listening to them, I am not helping them. I'm actually supporting their suffering. Now, what do you do then? That's another discussion. But it's at least knowing, you know, we sometimes pretend that we're helping people when we may not be. Right? I mean, we all know that. And it's not like we're bad people. We're doing our best. But sometimes we don't have discernment. We're not willing to say, this is not working. Right? So, you know, I mean, my belief is it's really not that easy to really know what a compassionate act is. I mean, we know that it's relating to want to alleviate suffering in another human being. But to actually be successful in that, in a long-term outcome, we don't know, do we? So I think we should always try. We should always be doing our best. That should be the way we show up in the world. That's why we're not attached to outcomes. So you look. You know, you're, you know, Walter, you think you're coming from a wise place and you want to be helpful and you do something and it blows up in your face. Okay? Don't be disappointed. Don't be upset. That was interesting. Right? I mean, there has to be non-ego. You know, if ego is involved, ego wants an outcome. Right? It's like, hey, if I'm going to invest my money in this person, I want a payoff. I at least want them to say thank you, right? I mean, can you believe it? I didn't even get a thank you card. Right? That's how the ego works. It's always what? Quantify. Keeping score. It's like keeping score, like a referee. It's good to give that up. Is that clear? Good, thank you. Are there other questions, challenges? I mean, that's fine. I mean, it's all...
So with all of that in mind, detaching is a challenge because every person you think you're trying to help is going to require an individualized understanding of what's going on. Therefore, the way I detach from one person, or that not from the person, but from what I expect out of it, is going to be different each time, right? I mean, does it go, it's not as cut and dried as just backing off the ego.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. So this is not detachment, you know, like just separating yourself from and sort of being kind of just, I don't know what, kind of indifferent or just, no. This is, we might say non-attachment, because detachment sounds like you're, you know, like distancing. But it means you're, yeah, I mean, there's no cookie cutter. You know, there's some people who function in this world, they're just very nice. And there's no wisdom or intelligence to their niceness. Do you know what I mean? They're nice people. But, you know, when you get to know them, they're kind of got, a lot of them, you know, behind the scenes, they're not happy with the way people are responding to their niceness. And they often have an agenda about how, you know, their niceness should be responded by other people's niceness. You know? So, yeah, it is individual. That's why in our tradition, compassion is a practice. Compassion is something we train in, because it takes intelligence. It takes a willingness to be present to another human being, to be in their shoes, so to speak, to see the world from their point of view, and then to think, you know, what would be most helpful? Which is a very different stance than sort of doing it from me. This is what I think they should do. You see, that's where we usually approach it, right? Rather than really going, who is this person? And where are they at in their life? And what would be a skillful, helpful thing that would maybe move them along? Not according to my agenda, but according to their own suffering. And it sometimes, you know, it sometimes doesn't look like we think compassion should look. We think compassion should look what? Nice. Right, but I was talking to somebody the other week, you know, who has a son, and you know that the story of drugs, and you know that whole unfortunate downslide, you know, and the most compassionate thing was what, not to bail him out, right? Why? I mean, how could a parent not bail their child out of jail? That sounds what, cruel. But how could that be a compassionate act? What? That may learn more, you know, keeping them locked up at least keeps them off the street. You know what I mean? I mean, we have to kind of be wise that sometimes a compassionate act could be to, you know, anybody ever here been a parent? You know, sometimes the most compassionate thing to your child is, you know, go to your room. They may not want to hear that. You know, go to your room. Because you want them to learn something. Right, so compassion doesn't always look nice. That's what I'm saying, to say to somebody, well, you know, I understand, you've been telling me a number of weeks about this situation with this person, how much it's bothering you. Sounds like it's still the same, so let's talk about something else. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. Yeah. Yeah, your husband's just terrible. Yeah, I get it. You know, shall we move on? You know, I mean, how many times do we have to hear it? And it's not helping them, because every time they talk about how horrible their husband is, or how horrible their wife is, or how this is, their mother is, their children is, what are we reinforcing? That thought. And that feeling, which is not good for their relationship, is it? Right? I mean, I'd much rather talk to them about, well, you know, I mean, my response a lot to people when they go on their way, my first response is, well, why don't you leave them? Yeah, anybody that horrible, I wouldn't live with. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then all of a sudden they go, what? What'd you just say? Yeah, well, leave them. I get it. They're a really terrible person. I wouldn't live with them. You know, and it kind of stops them in their tracks because you've just taken what they're telling you to the obvious conclusion. And then they have to say what? What? Yes, you see? And now you've changed the conversation. Yeah, you know, well, I'm not ready to do that. Okay. Well, then let's talk about what we can do. And how can we talk about that? You see, that's a wholesome conversation, isn't it? The other one just reinforces suffering. So like you're saying, Bob, it's not easy, you know, when you to really help or to know when we're supporting suffering in someone. You have a hand up over here.
Thank you, Fred. We encounter people in our lives that we feel are not showing up the right way. There are a lot of unwholesome acts, things that bother us or annoy us or hurt us. And we have learned here that we need to try to understand that because of causes and effects, and maybe during their childhood or during their life, they have suffered, and then I think that may be an act of compassion to say, okay, well, they don't know better. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we're taught that we're also a product of causes and effects, and we through discipline and work and meditation, we transform ourselves or try to transform ourselves. Mm-hmm. So how come that applies to us, but it doesn't apply to them? Or it's just a statement of compassion again, saying, okay, they're a product of causes and conditions. I just have to take it like that.
Well, let me just say, and that's a good question. I mean, my response would be, it's not either or, it's both and. So don't get caught in either or. So there's somebody who's doing great harm in the world or just in your life, you know. Why are they doing it? Because of their causes and conditions. You know, you say, you look at your president and you go, well, if I had grown up in his family and everything that he had ever done in his life happened to me, I might be just like him. I probably would be just like him. Okay? So that's an understanding how much we are shaped. Right? By, you know, causes and conditions, okay? So that's at least gives you some understanding to understand, you know, see, you say you know better, right? There are lots of people that don't know better. Have you noticed that? But we think they should know better. But that's our criteria. But if they knew better, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. They don't know better. In Buddhism, we call that ignorance. They're ignorant of how things really are. They don't see, you know, the effects of their actions and how much they're contributing to the suffering of other people. They might think they're actually doing what? What? You know, and we find that, you know, that really bothers us, that somebody could actually be doing things that we think are so terrible for the world, and they think they're helping. They're making the right decisions. It just galls us, doesn't it? You know? We go, you know, we froth at the mouth too. But the truth is, if we were somewhat rational, we go, you know, they really believe it. Okay? So when you have that kind of understanding, at least it allows you to operate in the world without all this shock and unbelievable and anger, and it shouldn't be this way because it is that is the way it is. Now, it doesn't mean you don't act based on your principles, your beliefs. You can act very strongly. but you act from wisdom. That's the difference. Yeah, so, I mean, this is not a an invitation for a passivity, right? But it's an understanding. Like you said, there are people in this world that are what? What? Unwholesome, toxic. Some, you know, that just, isn't that the truth? You know, I mean, whether we like it or not, whether we think these kind of people shouldn't be in the world or not, the problem is what? What? Let's hear it. They are in the world. And you know what? Right now, they're in there, whatever they, wherever they go to, and they're concerned that you're in the world. How do you like that? Right? And so here we are. And if we don't understand that, then we end up what? Hating, dividing, getting more and more entrenched in seeing the other as the other, the enemy, which is only going to create more suffering. You know, there's no way out of that one except more suffering. So there is another way. But it's not passive. It's a way of understanding. Understanding in this moment, they can't help showing up this way. Doesn't mean the next moment something couldn't change. Right? You changed. But you changed when? When somebody told you to change? No. People probably told you to change for years. Right? Right? You just blew them off, didn't you? I mean, but that's the truth for all of us, right? And one day, all of a sudden, you decide what? Not one day, you know, but over a process. So you decide what? I need to change. Right? And then that begins to happen. But yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just change people by some kind of magic wand or saying the magic word? But people are deeply entrenched in their beliefs, you know. You know, when Thich Nhat Hanh did the 14 mindfulness trainings, the rewriting, he put attachment to beliefs and ideology as number one in this world today, ahead of all the traditional ones. He really saw, you know, from his country of Vietnam, you know, just how attachment to ideologies and ideas, you know, was so dangerous. Because we start hating other human beings based on their ideas. You know, we used to hate them because they took over our territory. Remember the good old days? It's like, you know, they kind of marched in and took over our territory and we're going to, you know what I mean? It was like, but now we kill each other over ideas. It's, am I right? Because you're such and such. I mean, it's very dangerous times. So we have to be careful that we don't fall into it. Yes. Maybe one more and then we'll stop.
I really have a problem with the disconnect with being the change I wish to see and, you know, understanding the causes and conditions. But at the same time, I mean, I still want a representative for the next election who's going to kick some ass, you know.
To what?
I still want a representative for the next election who's going to kick some ass. I want someone who's a fighter. Okay.
That's okay.
A fighter. I really
well,
do.
Well, hold on. Stop. All right, it's okay. Yeah, I mean, again, as I said earlier, you know, skillfulness in action is dependent on lots of conditions, right? As I said, sometimes when you're parenting a child, being very loving and supportive and kind, and right, is the way to go. You know, sometimes you got to send them to their room. Sometimes you got to say no. Sometimes you got to, no, you're not going out this weekend. Right? So, but the important thing is that not be done based on anger, out of hatred, out of frustration, right? But out of wisdom that this is what, in the time, this is what is, I think, is needed. Okay? And one can do that without hating, without demeaning the other. We have to be very careful, right? Our political discourse has become so personal and demeaning. It's like a race to the bottom, as they say. And, you know, and if everybody jumps on that bandwagon of demeaning and being so disrespectful to other human beings, even if they have a different ideology than us or different ideas, you know, it's not going to end good. So you can have political views, right? And you can feel what the best way to go would be. But it's because you think that's what's effective and going to work. But also you have to have the big picture. What kind of world do I want?
Right. But I mean, I look at that, and then, for example, you know, if you saw Marianne Williamson and you look at her, you know, outlook on things versus, you know, a Kamala or something like that, if you were watching the debates, I mean, just having someone who is peace and love, unfortunately, I don't think that's enough.
That's your idea. But Raven,
yeah,
that's fine. You know, the problem is, you know what the problem is? We live in a democracy. I mean, just to be honest with you, that's the problem. And in a democracy, do you know what? I mean, a functional democracy, people are allowed to have what?
Opinions. We
want everybody to have our opinion.
No, my point is the disconnect between, like, person to person is much easier to understand causes and conditions and be kind to someone and look at them in the eyes and be understanding. Mm-hmm. But as a whole, I really think you need to kick some ass again.
That, yeah. And that is fine if that is your view, you know. Uh-huh. But again, all I would say, that's fine. I mean, but you got to think, is that, you know, where is that going to lead? I don't know. I mean, if I'm over here, what's kicking ass? And then the other people say, well, that's what we got to do, and then we got to raise it up a little more, you know.
No, I get it, but that's my problem. It's a disconnect. How do I get out?
Hey, Raven,
of that?
Raven, the world's a mess, and in this mess, we have to do our best to act wisely and compassionately. That's all. You know, there's no easy answers these days, and there's no purity. You know. It's a mess. You know, when you clean up a mess, ever clean up a mess? You know, it's messy, right? I mean, it's, and so, yeah, I mean, it's, but again, it's not either or. It's both and. Yeah. And we want to do our best to kind of bring our actions into congruence with our values and our aspirations for the world. Which is not easy. I mean, I'm not, a couple of generations ago, you know, we were all just, you know, working on the farm or something. You know, it was much simpler, wasn't it? Now we have lots of choices and decisions, political, all kinds. It's a very complex world we live in, isn't it? And yet we can't get lost in it. We have to always have the ground of our own values, our own aspirations for ourselves and the world. And that, you know, that's got to be central. To me, that's what spirituality, religion should be about. It's this inwardness that we're coming from some place of value and meaning. Okay? So we will stop here. Thank you, everyone.